The Phoenician Scheme, an epic comedy adventure directed by Wes Anderson and starring Benicio del Toro. Zsa Zsa Korda must survive assassinations, win back his daughter, and pull off the greatest scheme of his lifetime, The Phoenician Scheme, rated PG-13, now playing in select theaters in New York and Los Angeles, everywhere June 6th. Happy Saturday. It's May 31st, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
Michael, how's summer going over there? Is it treating you well?
Well, we had a rainy May. It's, you know, I'm optimistic that June is going to be sunny and bright. That's the reason for summer. It's got to be optimistic.
Michael, I'm very glad to hear it. Well, I want to say that we have a sunny, bright, and optimistic episode of Morning Meeting, an issue of Airmail for you, and we do. But first, in the news. Well, this week, everyone was talking about the slap heard around the world, which pitted Brigitte Macron against her husband, the president of France. The Élysée described this encounter quite peculiarly as, quote, a moment of closeness. But are we the only ones that were kind of wishing it had been Melania? Meanwhile, on Thursday, the Swiss village of Blatten was nearly destroyed as a landslide wiped out 90% of it. Fortunately, its 300 residents had previously been evacuated. Meanwhile, at Harvard, the drama continues as the Trump administration tries to block the college from enrolling international students. Meanwhile, Harvard says that the ones who are there are already trying to transfer out. As usual, airmail is the antidote to all of the distressing topics of the day, and oh boy, what a fun day we have in store.
Yeah, you know, it goes without saying we are at a crucial moment in American history, no matter your politics. And this week, Sam Tannenhaus is going to join us to discuss the life and impact of William F. Buckley, the man who, in many ways, set the stage for the modern conservative movement that has reached a new iteration in Donald Trump. Sam has written a magnificent new book about Buckley, and it's a gripping account of a consequential life. Then, speaking of consequential figures, we're going to consider someone who you may never have given much thought to, but who also left an enormous impact on Hollywood and how the American dream is portrayed. We're talking about Desi Arnaz Jr., and Todd Purnham has just written a revealing and riveting new biography of a man who is often seen as nothing more than Mr. Lucille Ball, but he'll tell us all about Arnaz's groundbreaking life and career. And finally, we've got a special treat. Cassie David will join us from Los Angeles to share her answers to 51 of life's most pressing questions in this week's Perfect Ending. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Michael, we have absolutely no choice. We have to get Sam Tannenhaus on here to talk about his incredible new book, Buckley, The Life and the Revolution That Changed America. This is a gripping, fascinating biography of America's premier conservative thought leader of the 20th century. And Sam does him much justice. He is the former editor of the New York Times Book Review and also the author of the national bestseller, Whitaker Chambers, A Biography, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, among other accolades. He's currently a contributing writer for the Washington Post. Welcome, Sam.
Hey, great to see you both.
So, Sam, I know that this is blasphemy to you, but there are some people out there who are going to confuse Bill Buckley with Jeff Buckley and many other Buckleys out there. So before we talk about the 25-year operation to create this wonderful new book that you have authored, give us a primer.
Okay, so we're not going to do anything on that great version of Hallelujah.
Not yet. Buckley
is the intellectual architect of the modern right and the modern conservative movement. Like, if you think of it having an infrastructure, which we know it has, it's an infrastructure built on media, a lot of it. Nowadays, it's podcasts, it's websites, it's social media, it's all the books. Go on Amazon and look at all the books coming out of the right. Buckley pioneered every bit of that. Television, he did the first big and by far the best ever debate show. People still go on YouTube to watch. Someone told me the other day, Buckley and Netanyahu, or Buckley and Woody Allen, Buckley and Muhammad Ali. He invented the form. You bring somebody in, you have the conversation with them, and you use that to open the gateway to pull people into your movement. So all these very accomplished people we see online now are, whether they know it or not, and most of them do know it, they know they're the godchildren of William F. Buckley. He saw the debate was cultural. Politics is really about culture. It's not about who gets more taxes than the other person. We see how easily that argument changes. And he knew it was about media. So Variety at one point, Variety said he's the one-man media operation for all seasons. He's doing everything. He's doing columns. He's doing magazines. He's doing books. He's on Laugh-In, you know, the old television show. He's everywhere. And that's how you get the message out. And he invented that for our time. And he did it with humor and wit, which is what we don't have now.
And where did he come from, Sam? And when did he become so well-known? What sort of writing was he doing and where was he doing it?
Okay, he grew up in what in Connecticut we call the Northwest Corner, Sharon, Connecticut, which is right across the border from Dutchess County, New York, and right near Western Mass, the Berkshires. But his family's from the South. His father was from the Rio Grande Valley. His mother was from New Orleans. So he had this odd Southern thing about him. That's where a lot of the politics came from. So Bill Buckley was a guy who was raised as an aristocrat, although he was a Catholic whose parents came from the South. He went to prep school in New England. He went to Yale. He was the guy at Yale. He was famous before he left the campus in the late 40s because he was already attacking his professors, calling them atheists and socialists. He made that his first book. The first book, which is basically a summary of textbooks used at Yale, was a New York Times bestseller because he knew how to push the buttons. So here are things he said that sounded outrageous then and don't sound outrageous today. Alumni should take over universities and fire the faculty they don't like. Now, where have I heard that? And they should dictate curriculums. And there's actually no such thing as true free speech on campus, because if you disagree with liberal professors, they shut you down. And that book was published in 1951 when he was 25. He's saying the same thing conservatives say now. He just got out in front. So that made him famous. Then he started a magazine 4 years later called National Review, the only conservative publication from that era that's still in print. His National Review. One man show. He was publisher and editor. He owned a majority of the stock. And at that point, he was 29 years old. He'd already taken over the movement, become this really dominant figure. He's friends with all the worst people on earth. He's friends with Joe McCarthy, Roy Cohn. You name a bad guy, he was Bill Buckley's friend. But he's also Joan Didion, Graydon Carter. He knows them all, you know, the cool people, the socialites. And that's what he did. He built a universe around himself. And that's why once he was gone, there was no one left to fill the vacuum.
Sam, you've been working on this book for 25 years. How did the political climate of that time influence your decision to work on this project?
What a great idea. Okay, so when I started on it, for those of you who can turn the clock back that far, it was the peak of the American centuries. 1998, communism was finished. That was Bill Buckley's great ideological achievement. He said, we can actually win the Cold War, which sounded hilarious when he started saying it. But that's what his spy novels, also bestsellers, were about. These fantasies, the anti-Le Carré novel, he had a dozen that were bestsellers. How America could win the Cold War. Suddenly his hand-picked protege, Ronald Reagan, is in the White House. And Buckley's friend from Skull and Bones and the Bohemian Grove in California, George Bush, succeeds him. Very clubby world we're talking about here. Actually, very white, very male, very clubby, very old family, lots of money. But they're the guardians, as they call them. All this comes to fruition. So I thought, okay, I will write the book about the triumph of the American right. And then all this other stuff followed. So that colored the writing of the book. So this book began to take its shape when my wife, who does a lot of the research with me, and I went to Camden, South Carolina, where the Buckley family, when he was growing up, had their winter estate in an antebellum mansion built by the great Civil War diarist Mary Boykin. They lived there, and I discovered the other publication the Buckley family had been involved in that no one knew about because they didn't talk about it. And it was a segregationist newspaper in the South. So historians who've looked at the book, you know, professional academic historians say that discovery opens up the whole conservative movement, because you see how Buckley the patrician, the anti-communist patrician, connects with all that stuff, the race stuff that came out of the South. They all passed through him. And that's when the book became a different story. It became a detective story. And these biographies, the kind I write, they're not standard classic biographies, cradle to grave. It's always about a big thing that happened. And for him, and for the reader, and for me, it's peeling away the layers to get at what was at the base of his life and of the movement. And that's the news in the book, I think.
I mean, Sam, this took you 25 years to write. It's over 1,000 pages. It weighs 3 pounds. I mean, this is a good bicep curl exercise for some of us.
Very good. Thinking man's kettlebell, somebody told me.
What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced in your reporting and also in piecing this story together?
Well, first of all, you can't put everything in. This is a guy who wrote two separate books, 10 years apart, each about 1 week in his life. The life is beyond belief, how much he did, how much energy and excitement he brought to it. Now, his great friend and protege, Gary Wills, great writer, one of my heroes, said, he said, Bill was just exciting to be around. He had that quality, that Gatsby-like thing. Like, he's looking at you and you're the only person in the room. I never knew so brilliant and gifted a person who was so great a listener. And that was another discovery. Why was he such a great listener? Because that's how he wins the debates. What did you just say? That's the opposite of what you said two sentences ago. Which one is it? He invented all of that until two guys were even better, James Baldwin and Gore Vidal. And they beat him. Those guys actually won their debates.
Sam, he had such a dust-up on television in 1968 against Gore Vidal. Take us back into that moment, because for many Americans, that's sort of ingrained in the memory of that year and that election cycle.
You bet it is. It's the single most embarrassing moment in his life. But you have to remember, the famous exchange is when in the 1968 Chicago convention, which was, we think our politics and elections are troubled now. In 1968, there were riots in both cities where the conventions were held, Miami and Chicago. There were two assassinations of beloved American heroes, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., within 2 months. And these guys now were brought face to face when riots are going on in the streets. And the moderator, Howard K. Smith, says to Gore Vidal on live TV, ABC television, 10 million people watching, said, Mr. Vidal, aren't these people acting like Nazis out there, hoisting the North Vietnamese communist flag? And Buckley chimes in and says, yes, that's true. And Vidal says to Buckley, the only Nazi here is you, Bill. And Buckley, in those words he never lived down, said, shut up, you. He called him, you pink queer, or I'll sock you in the jaw and you'll stay plastered. And that queer was bleeped in screens across the country. And it was a humiliation for Buckley. Now, the important thing to know about it is that was the 9th or 10th debate in 12. Vidal had been playing Buckley from the beginning. That's what I found when I really studied closely the transcripts and the tapes. From the very beginning, the first debate in Miami, Vidal was gay baiting Buckley, because the rumors were always that Buckley was gay. He'd get compared to Oscar Wilde and Noel Coward. And in those days, those were the signifiers, right? And Vidal was goading Buckley by suggesting he was gay.
Sam, Buckley died in 2008. He didn't live to see the rise of Trump. You mentioned earlier, like, the heirs of Buckley are what, I mean, his influence is around us still. But when you look at the current landscape, do we see his influence in the current administration? Do we see, and is anyone his specific heir that we should be looking at?
I don't think there's a specific heir. There was never anyone like Buckley before him, and there hasn't been anyone like him since. Where you can see some connection, Michael, is in the ideology. So 1958, when Buckley was 33 and already very famous, he told another famous guy no one remembers, Mike Wallace, the interviewer. Wallace said, well, what do you want to do? What are you aiming for? He said, I want a counter-revolution in this country. I said, well, what would that consist of? It would consist of overturning everything that came out of the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt. Well, guess what's happening now? So in that sense, Buckley would say, yeah, that's what we had in mind. It doesn't mean he wants Elon Musk, you know, putting Post-its on people's desks when they go off to the restroom, telling them they're fired when they come back. But his idea was too much government, get rid of it. Buckley declared war on colleges and universities in his first book, God and Man at Yale. It's what they're doing now. So in that sense, the culture war is being advanced along lines that Buckley had in mind. I don't know what Buckley would have done with the stuff that's going on. I can tell you one thing. He would just cringe through the language, cringe through the epithets, and the garbled syntax. I cannot imagine. Buckley never had Donald Trump on his program firing line when he easily could have. Why not? I think for one thing, he couldn't stand listening to him. So I think that would be hard for Buckley. And he didn't like either when people called him a fascist or Nazi, which is what set him off with Vidal, or when people treated him and his movement like boobs and yahoos. He didn't like it. And that's what's happening now. He became an inside media guy. He was proud of being part of the intellectual and cultural establishment, even when he was waging war against the political ends, you know, when he's an outer. So that would have been a real problem for him, I think.
Well, Sam, your wonderful book, which everyone absolutely must read, I mean, it does really take us back to a much more civilized intellectual era in American politics. And I have to say, we have a real nostalgia for it. So thank you again for your incredible analysis and also for a quarter century of work on this very worthy subject.
So great talking to you both, and thanks for having me.
Why don't we move on to another equally fascinating period of American history, the time when Desilu Productions loomed large.
Yeah, I'm excited about this book. You know, like many people, we grew up with I Love Lucy, one of the shows that Desi Arnaz created, but it's an amazing sort of like framing of a life that you never considered before.
Yes, I learned so much from this piece by Todd Purdom. He's the former New York Times political reporter and the author of Something Wonderful, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Broadway Revolution. Welcome, Todd.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So Todd, even in the inside story piece that you wrote for the issue of Airmail about your new book, Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television, I learned so much about one of America's favorite father figures and television personalities of that period. I mean, what interested you in Arnaz as a subject?
Well, I think just the fact that he has been under-celebrated. Everyone knows Lucille Ball. Everyone knows her comic genius. Everyone knows her sheer skill with physical comedy, with props. And obviously, people think of Arnaz as playing Ricky Ricardo very effectively as a straight man, a comic foil for her adventures. I don't think people understand quite so fully how much he had to do with getting the show on the air and then turning the success of the show into an empire of television production in Hollywood in the 1950s.
So Todd, tell us a little bit, I mean, to your point, I mean, as I said, I never knew any of his origin story or then the arc of his life. So tell us a little about where he came from, what drove him, and kind of what haunted him as he achieved success.
It's an interesting question, Michael, because in some ways, the things that drove him are also the things that haunted him. He was raised in Cuba, the privileged only child of a very wealthy family. His father was the mayor of Santiago de Cuba, the second largest city. His mother's father was an executive at the Bacardi Rum Company. And in the 1933 revolution, the so-called Sergeant's Revolt that overthrew the corrupt Machado regime, his family fled to Florida with nothing in its pockets, basically. And Desi reinvented himself as a self-taught musician. He got hired by the king of the rumba, Xavier Cugat, to play at the Waldorf Astoria. And then he more or less introduced the conga dance craze in nightclubs in the 1930s, got spotted by Rodgers and Hart, got a part in a Broadway show, and then wound up in Hollywood to make the movie of that show where he met his co-star and future wife, Lucille Ball. And the rest is history. But in some ways, the youthful dislocation, the trauma of losing everything as a teenager drove him to succeed. It also came to haunt him. When he did succeed, I think he would clearly be said to have suffered from what we'd now call PTSD.
Well, as you note as well, I mean, he really was, you know, the first Latino entertainment mogul. But before we get to what haunted him, I think we take so much for granted now, and it seems like it always is that way. But this is a guy who, through his innovative thinking, really invented television as we know it, and did so with how he shot I Love Lucy and basically how he monetized it. So can we talk about that a little bit?
Yes, he really early understood what so many people in Hollywood now understand, which is if you own the IP, if you own the intellectual property and the content, you'll be king. And because in those days, television was centered in New York, but Lucy and Desi wanted to live in Los Angeles. And at that point, there was not yet any way to broadcast a live television signal coast to coast. CBS said, if you want to do this show in Hollywood, you will have to film it, and that's going to cost more. And Desi said, okay, we'll take the pay cut, but then I want to own the film. And because nobody had yet been running reruns in a medium that was virtually 100% live, nobody quite understood the value of that. There's some suggestion that Desi thought it might have saleability in the foreign market. But by making the decision to preserve the show on pristine 35mm film stock, he basically invented the rerun and then ultimately syndication sales, because if a program could be shown again and again, it could be sold again and again. And that's the business model of television that endured for 7 decades until streaming came along. And it's also why we still today can see I Love Lucy looking as fresh and crisp as ever.
So he does all that despite what we're seeing on screen, the relationship between him and Lucille Ball, which is idyllic, that sort of like wonderful home life. He's falling apart behind the scenes, right?
Yes, they did have a great love affair, he and Lucy, but it was one of those love affairs in which they couldn't be with each other and they couldn't be apart. He had 2 big flaws. The first was that he was faithful only in his fashion, and he had the Latin man's idea that dalliances, especially with prostitutes, which were his particular thing, didn't matter at all in the context of his marriage. Lucy didn't really ever buy into that. And then as his success increased, so did his reliance on alcohol, and he ultimately self-medicated to the degree that he was like, you know, drinking tomato soup with vodka at 11 o'clock in the morning. And at the very height of the commercial and artistic success of Desi Lu, the production company they created, he was falling apart in alcohol. And then the last 25 years of his life was basically kind of a sad spiral into depression and alcoholism. And he died at only 69.
And how did Desi and Lucy finally break ties and break contact? I mean, tell us about sort of their professional and personal divorce.
They got divorced in 1960. Then in 1962, Lucy bought him out of the company because, frankly, he didn't have the cash flow to be able to do that at that point. And they had had reached an agreement when the company went public that one could buy out the other. But they never broke contact. And in fact, I think they had what you'd probably have to call a very successful divorce. Without the strain of actually being married, they grew closer to each other. They stayed in frequent contact. Lucy relied on him for business and professional advice. They stayed close relative to the bringing up of their children. They each remarried pretty happily, really. But when Desi was dying, Lucy went down to see him at the beach in Del Mar, north of San Diego, where he lived. And their daughter, Lucy Arnaz, put on some tapes of old I Love Lucy episodes, and they found themselves laughing and remembering the good times.
I mean, Todd, I Love Lucy changed the way that television comedies were made. In what ways are you still seeing that influence play out in today's shows?
Yeah, it's such a good question. You see it in every episode of Friends, in every episode of The Big Bang Theory. In most television sitcoms are still made live in front of a studio audience with 3 cameras at once, which is the best way people have decided to capture audience reaction, to capture the spontaneity. You don't have to recreate the comedy in multiple camera setups the way in a single camera setup the way you would in making a movie. And so when lightning happens, you're there to capture it all at once.
Todd, you mentioned you know, how Desi kind of basically realized IP before anyone knew what that phrase was. Just curious, do you know who controls the Desi Lu IP these days?
Yes, it's either going to be David Ellison or Sherry Redstone. I mean, it's part of the Paramount CBS empire, but there's one chunk of it, 15% chunk, that is still controlled by the family of I Love Lucy's original producer, Jess Oppenheimer, who decided when Desi and Lucy sold their part back to CBS to help finance the expansion of their studio, the Oppenheimer family held on to it, and they have held on to it to this day. But basically, it's under control of Paramount, and I Love Lucy mostly lives these days on Paramount Plus.
Todd, thank you so much. Congratulations on the publication of this wonderful book. We look forward to the next conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Todd.
The Phoenician Scheme, an epic comedy adventure directed by Wes Anderson and starring Benicio del Toro. Zsa Zsa Korda must survive assassinations, win back his daughter, and pull off the greatest scheme of his lifetime. The Phoenician Scheme, rated PG-13, now playing in select theaters in New York and Los Angeles, everywhere June 6th. Well, speaking of things that are lodged in our minds, Cassie David is here to interpret the world of the internet, youth culture, Hollywood, and many other topics for us. And now she has a new book coming out, and we are very excited to speak with her about it. Cassie is a columnist at Airmail and the author of No One Asked for This, a collection of essays about social media and, hooray, millennials. Welcome, Cassie.
Hello, I'm here.
There is a God. Okay, before we get into your favorite and least favorite things in the universe, apparently you have a new book coming out. Qu'est-ce que c'est?
I do, yeah. I just learned about childbirth amnesia. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I suffer from it, or whatever the opposite of suffering from it is.
Yes.
I benefit from it.
I realized that, you know, I had to have some form of that in order to even write a second book. I forgot how horrible it was the first time in order to even be able to do it the second time.
First of all, what is your second book about? What's the name of it? Give us the skinny.
It's called Delusions, and it kind of takes place the year between my 29th birthday and my 30th birthday. And it's really about the pressure to kind of get your entire life together before you turn 30, which kind of descended on me. And you don't really realize how delusional it is until you come out of it. But it's all about how you're supposed to feel wiser and then less insecure. And all of these things we're told about turning 30, that like you just suddenly stop caring about what people think, and how that really just didn't happen, no matter how hard I tried. So that's kind of the overall premise. And then there's some sprinkled in of just kind of the spirals you can really only care about when you're young and stupid, and the realization that you're no longer going to be young and stupid, just probably stupid.
It's also very effing funny. That's all. I mean, okay.
Yeah.
I gotta like juice it up here for you, because I know you're gonna hold back.
Certainly, yeah. Well, that's one of the things. Also, we talk about that. My personality isn't really suited for a 30-year-old person. Like, can you even be self-deprecating as a 30-year-old adult? I don't know. We'll see.
Cassie, I mean, have you ever seen a Woody Allen movie? I mean, that guy's like 85 years old and still being self-deprecating.
Yeah, and he's doing great.
Well, you know, all things considered, he's still around.
Sure is. Yeah.
So, Cassie, tell us, I mean, how do you feel different as a 30-year-old versus a 29-year-old, or as a woman in your 30s? Is it better or worse than you expected it to be?
I think it's like, it's funny because it's the major change I felt as I approached 30 wasn't really the quantity of insecurities, but more the quality of them. Like, me and my friend's insecurities no longer stem from, you know, seeing like an ex's new girlfriend on Instagram, but now from, you know, the photo of the massive engagement ring he bought her. So it's just like a different texture. And the insecurities come from seeing all these people you've grown up with whose lives are taking really like concrete shapes, while you have like a lot of really important decisions to make that you're completely emotionally immature, not emotionally mature enough to have figured out yet. And there's things like this pressure that you need to find a life partner, that you're going to, someone you need to spend the rest of your life with, if you're going to have kids, all these things. So I would say that's the biggest difference, is actually feeling that pressure of, you know, that you're told you have so much time, and then one day you wake up and there's literally no time at all.
Honey, just wait until you reach our phases of life.
Yes, it's about this phase of life.
Okay, Cassie, let's get into the meat and potatoes of this segment, which is your favorite and least favorite things. Michael, where shall we begin?
I think my favorite one might have to do with your favorite excuse.
Was I'm not on antidepressants, right?
Well, I think specifically my SSRIs aren't working.
Yes. Yeah.
When's the last time you employed that, Cassie?
You know, I unfortunately have to do it all the time.
Today when you ordered coffee.
I should be using it more than I do. It's kind of the excuse I wish I employed more.
Now, you also say that your favorite piece of advice is not to listen to the advice of others, but I'm sure at some point in your life or career or something, you've taken a piece of it. So have you ever had any good advice from anyone ever?
Well, it's ironic because that is a piece of advice. So I don't know. I think I decided on that one just because you receive, it kind of goes back to the book where you receive so much advice, particularly for your romantic life during this age. And I find the advice you get is can actually ruin your life in a strange way, where it's like, you know, or marry your best friend or all of these things. I think when you're in a place of like vulnerability where you're trying to figure out your life and you're getting all this advice from all these different people, it can really have a negative effect. It's quite dangerous, where you could just end up, you know, there's so much stuff. Like if you just turn on any podcast where we're talking about dating, they're like, if you're not sure, like break up with him. It's like, well, what if he's like a really nice guy and you just had very normal doubts? So that's where the piece of advice comes from.
Okay. There were a couple of your responses that I have to confess I didn't totally understand. I need to know exactly what happened to your favorite shoes, your ballet flats from The Row. This story piqued my interest.
It's incredibly upsetting, isn't it?
Okay. What happened to them?
I had gone on a date a few years ago. It was kind of a swimming date in the summer. I had left my favorite shoes, The Row ballet flats, which only comes up because I was asked what my favorite shoes are. Just to be clear, I wouldn't just start talking about The Row ballet flats. And I ended up leaving them in the car of the person I was on a date with. I asked him about them once, like, hey, like I left my shoes. I don't want you to think I'm that girl who like left them on purpose. This is a thing. It's become a cliche. It's actually ruined it for the people who genuinely leave things like accidentally. a lot of girls have left, you know, it's become a cliche where they'll leave a shirt and they'll be like, I left like my shirt at your house. Like, I have to come get it. And as an excuse to see them again. I really didn't want him to think that. So I was like, I'm only going to ask once and hopefully that'll be enough. It wasn't. And now, like, years later, I'm missing these shoes on a near daily basis. I can't bring myself to ask about them again. I don't want him to think I'm just trying to see him again.
This guy is still in your life.
Yeah, he's someone I know, but it's not like we're talking all the time and I don't want to just randomly text him like about my shoes, you know?
What do you think if he's wearing them, maybe?
Like, what would you do? You would have asked.
1000%. Are you kidding me?
You're a mature adult. I'm like so embarrassed that he's going to think I'm like trying to text him.
Cassie, those shoes are like $1,200.
I did get them on the RealReal, so they were a little less than that, but they're so important to me.
They can't be replaced. Last season row.
He probably listed them on the RealReal now.
By the way, I only have like 4 pairs of shoes also. Those were one of them.
Dude, I'm upset about this. Send me his number. I'm calling him. I'm going to get these back for you tomorrow.
That would be great. And it's just let my therapist do it.
I'm actually not joking. Okay. Anyway, you go to bed before midnight, but first of all, we know this. You have incredible skin. You microneedle. Can you just talk me through your bedtime routine?
Oh my God. You're going to hate this. And so is everyone listening. Currently, I'm really trying to like avoid Botox at all costs. And a facialist told me to like start taping my face. I tape my entire face most nights and I look like a 7-year-old like recovering from a facelift. But I really, part of the routine is, you know, I wash my face, moisturize, wait till it dries, and then tape the entire thing like a mummy. And then go to sleep just like frozen, you know, like I can't move. I think the thing is that you're just told you're not going to care what other people think when you turn 30. I'm 31 now. I really care still. Like, when's it going to happen?
By the way, I think the other flex to do is instead of saying, I left my shoes at your house, I left my face tape at your house. Which is cringier? See, you compare it. The shoes are the easy one.
Yeah, who cares about the shoes? Just freaking ask for them.
Now that we've dealt with bedtime, I want to talk about breakfast. You have 3 caffeinated beverages. What are those beverages?
So I'm starting out with a cappuccino, some coconut milk I've been having. I kind of switch up the milk every so often. And then I'm having maybe just like an Americano. And then I'm having like a really big matcha. And the matcha is elaborate. It's really elaborate. So there's coconut water in it. There's collagen in it. There's colostrum in it. There's honey, there's vanilla, it's blended.
And where do you get this?
It's a recipe I actually found on Instagram, but it's quite incredible and addictive.
Do you make it or do you go out for it?
No, I make it and it's kind of changed my life, I'm not going to lie. I'll write up the recipe for you, Michael. Do you think that's something you would do?
You lost him at colostrum.
I don't know, but I would try it, yeah.
What's your guys' morning beverage?
64 cups of drip coffee.
Yeah. Why drip? What is drip?
You know, just like in a coffee machine.
Oh, just like regular.
Yeah, just like plain coffee.
I heard the contempt in your voice. Oh, regular.
No, I just started to get fear that I was boring everyone. How obnoxious do I sound on a scale of 1 to 10? I'm talking about organic electrolytes and the row ballet flats.
This is my kind of segment. I'm sorry. I love it.
Do you think I'm relatable and people will want to read my book?
I've already pre-ordered 55 copies for everyone I know. Michael, you too?
You see me here over here. You know what I don't need in my life? More relatable people. I want someone that, you know, relatable people. I know that. That's like, everyone's going to want Cassie. Come on.
Michael.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, sorry, Brooke, you heard it here first. Michael wants Cassie. And like that, Cassie David, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Cassie.
Thank you.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel And be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at ml.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, ML Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Okay, Michael, I think we've talked a lot about books that we need to read, but it is the weekend. Please give us a way to pass the time.
Okay, I've got something. I was in this city last weekend for Memorial Day, and you know, I was poking around, and actually, you were good friends with Andrew Tarlow, the chef, weren't you?
I was not good friends with Andrew Tarlow, the chef, Michael. I only spent 70 to 80% of my paycheck at Diner between the years of 2004 and 2008.
Diner, the Williamsburg restaurant that kind of transformed the Brooklyn restaurant scene in the turn of the century, which you know well, but have you been to his new restaurant in Manhattan, Borgo?
No, but I'm dying to go. Next time I'm in town, we're going together.
Okay, next time we are going because Brooke and I went there. It was like a little treat, you know, after going to see Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. And I have to say, it is fantastic. You know, it's in the Nomad District. I call it the No-Man District because it's still sort of like empty at night over there. But it is a beautiful restaurant, and it's sort of his elevated take on an Italian restaurant. The food is fantastic. The staff was terrific, but it's called Borgo. It is in Manhattan. So if you're in the city this summer and you can't get to Italy, go to Borgo. And you, my dear?
I have two fabulous book recommendations. The first is The Heart-Shaped Tin by B. Wilson, Love, Loss, and Kitchen Objects. And in it, you know, she's a wonderful food writer. She's a columnist for the Wall Street Journal and has written some other wonderful books. But in it, she talks about the attachment that we form to everyday things in the kitchen, you know, the spoons, the bowls, the mugs. Why are we drawn towards them? Why do they loom so large in our memories? And why do we find that we just can't part with them, even though we know we should? So anyway, it's a wonderful book full of great essays, very heartfelt and a very fun summer read. It's called The Heart-Shaped Tin by B. Wilson. And I'm also working my way through Tim Bouverie's new book called Allies at War, The Politics of Defeating Hitler. Tim is one of our favorite historians, a guest on Morning Meeting, as often as we can have him. And here in the UK, Tim is definitely one of the preeminent interpreters of Churchill and his actions in World War II. In this book, he tells a wonderful story about the alliance that ultimately ended up winning the war, but it took quite a while to get there. And Tim tells it all in riveting detail with a very fast-paced, action-packed narrative. So for students of World War II, and we know you are Legion, we promise you will thoroughly enjoy this. It's called Allies at War, The Politics of Defeating Hitler. On that note, we would like to thank our sponsor, The Phoenician Scheme and Focus Features. Michael, will you please read us out?
Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. The theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Clouette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. But in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.